I was a 911 dispatcher for almost 11 years. 11 long years of receiving the calls of everyone from entitled do-gooders to terrified pleading victims of serious violent crimes. I spent a long time compartmentalizing the more harrowing calls, years letting go of the pain and suffering I soaked up like a sponge during the years I spent sat in front of a switchboard computer. I've had numerous sleepless nights, countless visits to state-appointed therapists, but only one emergency call really sticks with me, one that I couldn't ever shake off or push to the back of my mind. I have a copy of the transcripts to the call, so I'll be referencing my copy to ensure my recollection of the events are as accurate as possible. This is the story of the Ashlyn Jane Doe. Working in more than 6,000 call centers nationwide, 911 dispatchers form the vital link between callers in distress and emergency response teams that assist them. Through efficient handling and assessment, we reduce response times and help save lives. That's the idea that got me into the career in the first place, saving lives. I'd never been particularly athletic, so a career in law enforcement or the military was never really in the cards for me. That always bothered me. I grew up intensely idealistic, and I've always had my heart set on a career where I could help people, help make the world a better place. So when I found out that I could apply to be a 911 dispatcher and help play a part of such a vital public service, I jumped at the chance. We were told that the job wasn't for everyone, that it could take a serious psychological toll on those that volunteered. I know it sounds crazy, but that only made it more appealing. It was, after all, public service, service being the operative word. It would be rough, frustrating, even depressing sometimes, but I would be providing a much-needed aid to my fellow Americans, often during the darkest, most terrifying moments of their lives. I should also add that it requires specialist training to be a police dispatcher. Being a general call taker or even an emergency medical service dispatcher is a tough gig, but a police dispatcher was a cut above and we all knew it. Only the most intelligent, strong-willed, and decisive candidates are granted roles as police dispatchers. So naturally, I was over the moon when I passed the applicant's exam and was given a place on the training course. I was a pretty experienced member of the police dispatchers when the call from Ashlyn Jane Doe came through. Just a few hours into my shift, I recently returned from the break room with a flash of strong black coffee to fuel me throughout the night. You always seem to say a little prayer whenever a call is patched through, hoping it's nothing too serious, nothing too upsetting. But as soon as I heard the girl's voice, I knew it would be bad. You see, screamers are bad. You can barely hear them, they're incoherent, and basically you have to spend like the first 5 minutes of the call just getting them to breathe enough to communicate. But the worst by far are the whisperers. The whisperers call when whatever is putting them in danger is close, real close. Whisperers do so because they are in grave, imminent danger. Whisperers call because they're being hunted. 911, what is the address of your emergency? I asked. The call had already been picked up by a general call taker, patched through to me once it established that the caller needed the police.
Right across from the 4th Street laundromat.
There was a slight pause before the girl whispered. The fact that she didn't know exactly where she was gave me a terrible sinking feeling. This was going to be a rough one.
What's the problem?
I replied, trying to sound as casual as possible. Younger callers seem to respond better that way.
I've been abducted.
The way she sounded so calm, so matter-of-fact, it was utterly chilling. There was no hope in the girl's voice, even though she was so close now to rescue.
But you're at the laundromat?
I asked, consulting a map of the area. It was right in the middle of Ashland, surrounded by a commercial and residential district. She wasn't held up in some barn in the middle of nowhere, despite being thoroughly disturbed. I reassured myself with the thought that this would be an easy rescue.
No, I'm in the bedroom with him.
Him. The words seemed to rattle around in my skull. She was in the bedroom with him.
Do you know what color the house is?
I tried to change the subject slightly to garner more information, sure, but also to try to keep the girl calm, keep her mind occupied.
"No,"
was all she said. This was a spanner in the works, a big one. The police can't just go kicking in the door of every apartment or house opposite the 4th Street laundromat, yet before I could press her for more detail, she spoke again.
"Please hurry."
My heart rate began to pick up at this point. She was obviously in danger, perhaps extreme danger. I had to remain professional and continue my assessment of the situation.
"Does he have a weapon?"
I asked, already preparing to send out an APB to muster the officers required for a rescue.
"Got a taser."
She lowered her voice even further as she spoke, but still she didn't seem overwhelmed by fright. I considered for a moment that whoever was may have drugged the poor girl to keep her sedated.
"Are you injured?"
"A little."
Her whisper was haunting by the point. She sounded like she'd been driven half insane by the ordeal.
"Is there any way you can get out of the building?"
"I don't know. Without waking him, I'm scared."
She was broken by fear, numb with it.
"Is there a bathroom in the house?"
I remember my voice breaking. I was so scared for this poor little thing. I wanted so badly for her to just drop the phone and run. Run for her life.
"His bedroom is closed and he made it so it would make noise."
"Will he do something to you?"
I'd never been so intense. Not during my entire time as a dispatcher.
"Yeah, he had me tied up."
"Are you tied up now?"
"Well, no, I kind of freed myself."
"That's my girl," I remember thinking. She was a fighter, a survivor.
"Oh,"
she suddenly said.
I think I woke him up.
"Just set the phone down." My heart was in my mouth. There was silence, what seemed like minutes of uninterrupted silence as I half expected the screams to commence. Finally, I brought myself to say something, anything down the silent phone line.
Are you still there?"
How much longer?"
was all she asked. It broke my heart. I didn't know. I just didn't know. I kept her on the line as I immediately dispatched officers to the laundromat. Luckily, there were only two houses immediately opposite the place in what was otherwise an industrial complex. I can't tell you how relieved I was when I finally heard the voices of the dispatch officers. They'd broken into the house of the kidnapper and were in the process of freeing the poor girl from captivity. "Show me your hands. Put up your effing hands right now. Do it," I heard one of them bellow. I held back tears, knowing that that poor young woman was finally safe. Safe from him. She was most definitely in danger, too. When the police searched the house, they found the bodies of two other young women that had disappeared in the months before the critical 911 call. Jane Doe is called that because her identity cannot be revealed. Standard procedure for all victims of assault. Her abductor, Sean Michael Great, was found guilty of murdering Stacy Stanley and Elizabeth Griffith, and was later sentenced to death for his crimes. During the trial, he stated that despite having killed before, he had no intention of killing the kidnapped Jane Doe and was in fact intending to marry her. That's what really gets to me. The thought of the brutal, potentially short life that poor girl would have ended up living as the unwilling bride of such a murderous, unfeeling psychopath. Where she would be if she hadn't loosened her bindings, found the phone, and called in her own rescue on that fateful spring night. Ask a cop which day of the year they dread working the most. One or two might answer Christmas or Super Bowl Sunday, and I get that. But 9 out of 10 will give you the same tired look before they utter one single word. Halloween. Halloween might just be some light-hearted spooky fun for some, but for law enforcement, it's no joke. The small New England town I serve in has a spike of about 6 or 7 times the number of emergency calls on Halloween night alone. It really does bring out the absolute worst in people. I mean, there's the stuff we anticipate every year. Ungenerous houses having suffered a barrage of weaponized eggs, trees covered in toilet paper, homeowners complaining of juvenile trespassers. Those calls are manageable, but they bog down our on-duty officers so that when serious crimes happen, we're dangerously under strength. But all of the dumb Halloween mischief I've had to respond to over the years, all of it pales in comparison to what I found at the house on the end of Jefferson Street. That was a Halloween night I don't think I'll ever forget. I just responded to a call regarding a group of teenagers who had apparently been engaging in some pretty aggressive trick-or-treating, all without costumes. That type of stuff is exactly why I hate Halloween. No, what they were doing wasn't strictly illegal, but I can't exactly have a bunch of knuckle-draggers making trouble on a night like that, especially not with the hundreds of excited children roaming the streets. I lecture them. They roll their eyes, but I join the force to get into car chases with bad guys, not argue semantics with a bunch of stoned brats. They walk away, muttering stuff that I choose to ignore while I get back in my patrol car. The radio almost immediately buzzes to life. My dispatcher says something over the radio involving this rundown house over on Jefferson Street. I start the car up, listening as he describes a member of the public calling to report that the house has Halloween decorations that were too scary. She then says it's the second call that day and I should go over and check it out if I have a minute to spare. She always did have a sense of humor. She knew well I was off my feet. We had a little laugh about it. Like I said, we get some seriously ridiculous calls on Halloween. It's not just dumb kids. It's bitter, old misers and party poopers who honestly just resent people having a good time. This one good Christian lady calls us every year over trespassing trick-or-treaters on kids. Who calls the cops on actual children? Anyway, I carry about my duties, responding to calls and generally keeping an eye out for trouble. A few hours slip by, the sun sets. The smaller kids, led by their parents, disappear back into their homes until it's just a few older groups on their way to parties and whatnot. Then, the dispatcher gets on to me about this house on Jefferson. She says she had 3 more calls about the decorations, how they're scaring kids and even some parents, and she needs me to roll over there to check it out. Great. Arguing with some slasher movie-obsessed hermit who's probably about to get all sovereign citizen on me, just what I need to make me feel like a guardian of the innocent. Sometimes I feel like the world's grumpy stepfather, honestly. So I take the ride over there, to this smaller part of town that's a little more run down, arriving on Jefferson. I see the house immediately. There was absolutely no missing it. The old colonial-looking place was covered in Halloween decorations. Cardboard standees of vampires and zombies, a ton of fake cobwebs all over the porch. I think I counted like 20 carved pumpkins dotted all over the lawn. Pretty intricate designs, too. But hanging from a large oak just to the side of the house was the most disturbing Halloween decoration I had ever seen. Not disturbing because it looked real. The limbs of the figure were too rigid, the hair a little too artificial. But the placement of the thing, it really did set me on edge as I stared out of the patrol car at it. The figure hung by a rope from one of the oak tree's long, thick branches, drifting gently in the fall breeze. Look, I'm a cop. I've seen some stuff. I don't frighten easily. I'm very logical, very level-headed, but that thing sent a shiver down my spine. I stepped out of the car, keeping my eyes glued to the hanging decoration as I walked towards it, the sound of crunching leaves under my feet with each and every step. Reaching for the flashlight on my belt, I pointed the torch beam over towards the tree. I could see why people had called this in. The texture on the thing's skin, it was very graphic, blotchy and purple, almost like an actual corpse. I only took another few steps before I felt extremely foolish for my previous thought. The smell, the sickly sweet smell of death hung in the air along with what I thought was just a cheeky decoration. It wasn't. It was an actual corpse that had been hanging there all day. Hundreds of kids must have walked past there, only a few of them actually recognizing that the thing hanging from the tree was a real cadaver. I felt sick. Sprinting back to my patrol car, I radioed into dispatch to get the coroner out to Jefferson Street as soon as possible. My dispatcher was absolutely horrified when she learned what I had, that other people had been staring at a dead body all day, many of them none the wiser. The hanged man was a one Richard Dodd, a retired teacher who was reported to have been caught up in some vigilante pedo sting. According to investigating officers, Mr. Dodd had been tricked into revealing questionable interest to individuals that were posing as an underage girl. When they threatened to go public with some of the more despicable things he said online, Mr. Dodd had opted for the easy way out, systematically fashioning a rope and doing the deed, all without a thought for who might happen across his body. People give me a hard time for not being into Halloween as a holiday, for rolling my eyes when grown adults talk about how wasted they're going to get or what costume they have picked out. But if they knew the things that went on around them on that grisly night, things that are sometimes hiding in plain sight, I don't think they'd be so quick to celebrate. I was an emergency dispatcher for 9 years before Katrina hit. The summer before my junior year of high school, I decided to get involved with law enforcement after doing a couple of ride-alongs with the police department. I had half expected them to be full of car chases, wailing sirens, taking down bad guys, but when I saw what they really did during their patrols, it completely changed my opinion of cops in general. It wasn't about being cool with a badge and a gun. It was more about community policing. They knew people by their first names, helped the elderly with their groceries, and kept local kids out of trouble. They were making a difference, not just two guys on a power trip gunning people down for no reason. So I started running the radio part-time on the weekends and during the summer when I was out of school, eventually moving into a full-time position after high school when a position opened up. It's not exactly illegal for someone under the age of 18 to work at a dispatch center, but I wasn't allowed to actually answer 911 calls without an APCO certified operator on the console with me until I was fully employed and fully qualified. And just so you all know, APCO stands for Association of Public Safety Communications Officials, and it's standard all over the country for people to get certified by them before they can work in dispatch centers. It was, however, very illegal for me to run the NCIC, National Crime Information Center, computer without being certified to do so, and there was absolutely no way of that happening until my 18th birthday. So I ran the medical and fire dispatch console for all of Mobile County when I was part-time, and got my certifications when I graduated. I was also a volunteer firefighter, EMR, during this time as well. Also not illegal and quite common in rural parts of Alabama, but I suppose that's all another story. I was a 911 operator in Mobile, Alabama, the same day Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. We started getting lots and lots of calls from over in New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast for some reason. I guess because they started routing through to us after all the 911 centers to the west started going down. Anyways, I got a call from a woman who said she was trapped in her house on Gordon Street between Florida and Law. I was confused at first because we have a Florida street here in Mobile, and after checking and double-checking and not being able to find her address, I asked her what city she was calling from. New Orleans, came the reply. My heart sank. Water had completely flooded the ground floor of her home and was slowly, gradually rising. I asked her if she could find any way out of the house, if there were any accessible windows on the second floor she could use. She said no, that she lived in a small, single-story home that had an attic, and that was all. I tried to route her to New Orleans 911 and New Orleans Fire Department, but could not get through. Dispatch centers up and down the country were experiencing the same ridiculous volume of calls from the NOLA and Gulf Coast areas. When I finally did break through and reach a department somewhere, the lines were dead, brought down by the sheer ferocity that the hurricane brought. I tried to keep her calm, talking to her about her friends and family, the life she had before the storm arrived. She seemed like a popular woman. Her concerns were mostly for elderly relatives that were even less capable of protecting themselves than she was. I'll never forget that, the selflessness she displayed even when she was in such dire straits herself. When she said the water was waist high, I told her to climb up into her attic with some food and water to keep her going. She joked about emptying the fridge, taking everything up into the attic. Might as well finish off last night's leftovers if the refrigerator would need to be replaced. She was such a strong woman. It's amazing how the human spirit can bloom even in the worst of situations, something I've found time and time again while working those phones. After a while, I heard her voice begin to get panicky, her breathing becoming short. She began to tell me that the flood water was beginning to leak up into the attic through the floorboards, how she didn't expect the water to have risen so much. I was stunned. I hadn't expected that either. In fact, it came as such an unwelcome revelation that I began to panic myself. Other than the roof, there was nowhere for the woman to escape to if the water kept rising. I asked her if there were any attic windows she could climb out of. She said no. By that point, I was starting to really worry. She was indeed trapped in an enclosed space with floodwaters rapidly rising. In desperation, I told her to find something heavy, something she could use to bash out the roof tiles or smash through a ventilation unit so she could escape onto the roof. For a painful few minutes, I heard her grunting and cursing as she used some unknown object to try to break her way out. I listened as the strikes grew weaker and less frequent. She soon returned to the phone with terrible news.
I can't do it. I can't fit through the vent either. What am I going to do?
She was panicking, shouting now about the amount of water seeping into the attic, how it was ankle height and rising fast. I honestly felt my heart break in my chest when I heard her voice break as tears formed in her eyes. She was crying, and she was losing hope. I told her I would stay on the line with her for as long as she wanted me to. I did so, staying on the line and listening as she cried, prayed, cussed, and prayed some more. A little while later, I could hear her struggling to keep her head and phone above water, and then the phone went dead. To this day, I don't know if she lived or died. I quit the dispatch center about 3 months after Katrina. I booked myself into counseling sessions at a therapist's office over in downtown Mobile, hoping it could help me rationalize and compartmentalize some of the more horrific calls I had to handle. But I was surprised to hear that the therapist actually thought I should quit. He specialized in cop and dispatchers, the kinds of people who rub noses with the worst of the worst on a daily basis. He went on to explain that people only have so much of a capacity for trauma, how I may have just reached my limit. But I have no regrets. If I had to burn out the last of my wits staying on the line with that poor, ill-fated woman over in New Orleans, it was worth it. I'd do it all again in a heartbeat. The scariest thing that ever happened to me as a police officer here in the UK wasn't some horrendous terror attack or overly gory crime scene. The incidents that stick with you are the ones that involve what I like to call human drama. When you get an insight into just how terrifying a person's psyche can be and the things it can lead them to do. I arrived at my duty station at 6 o'clock in the morning. I had finished work at around 11 the previous night and ended up running into an assault on an old man on the way home. My journey into work was about an hour, so instead of getting home in a reasonable time, I get home after midnight. I have a quick bite with my wife and get to bed at around 1 a.m., giving me about 3 to 4 hours of sleep before I'm back on duty. It's one of the worst things about my job. We're expected to go above and beyond on a daily basis. That, I can tell you, can prove to be completely and utterly exhausting. It frays their nerves, makes the emotions rawer, and generally makes the job that little bit more difficult. Anyway, about 15 minutes into my early shift, I'm on station duties and a bloke comes in to tell us that he thinks his wife is missing. He seemed very reluctant to give us the details, and at one point, I have to drag information out of him. Essentially, they'd had some kind of domestic argument. She stormed out and didn't come home that night. I check her on the system, and she's actually been previously arrested for a couple of domestic violence incidences. I dig a little deeper, and I discover that they are actually against her son, rather than her husband. Situations like this are rarely black and white, but this one was just all kinds of convoluted. Now at this point I am very, very tired and definitely not in the best of moods. I read over the notes I had written down and confirm some details, and then send the fellow home to wait for his wife. I call around the local hospitals, check our own police databases to make sure she hasn't been arrested. I circulate her details to all units in the area and then type out a digital report on the incident. After that, I'd done all I was obligated to do, and technically there isn't actually anything else for me to do other than wait for my superior to provide guidance. I go and get a cup of coffee. All I wanted to do is sleep, but something is bothering me. Something about the husband. Despite no indicators of him having committed a crime, I was deeply suspicious of him. Whenever someone appears to be withholding information, there is always a reason, and the sooner we get to the bottom of that, the better. I went down to talk with the most senior officer available, asking him if I could go over to the guy's house, have a look around, and maybe talk to the husband again. The senior guy, this grizzled older sergeant, wasn't delighted with the suggestion, because it meant that he'd have to cover the desk due to being short-staffed, but he agreed, and off I go. I arrived at the house and began to talk to the husband. I ask him if I can have a look around, explaining that there might be something that could shed some light on where she might have gone. I make a preliminary inspection of the house, finding several containers of pills with weird names. A quick Google search reveals that this woman appears to be on a cocktail of antidepressants, mood stabilizers, and the like. I also find an insulin kit, leading me to believe that if she's a diabetic, her life could be in danger without medication. I asked the husband about these, and he mentions that his wife has had some, quote-unquote, emotional problems. I proceed to sit him down, remarking that there is a lot of medication here, then asking him if his wife has more than one insulin kit. He goes pale at this point. She'd left all her medication at home. I ask him where she keeps her handbag, and we end up checking her bedside cabinet. The handbag is missing, but I manage to take a look at a framed picture for future reference. I have absolutely no idea what this woman looks like, and ask her husband if I can search the room. He's beginning to completely break down at this point, and tells me I can do whatever it takes at this point to find his missing wife. Feeling distinctly uneasy at this point with a banging headache from sleep deprivation, I don't find any sign of missing clothes in the wardrobe or any secret stashes of cash or drugs. I don't know what led me to do it, but I decided to search the bed. I turned his pillow and there's a note under it. It's a note explaining in no uncertain terms that the man's missing wife has the intention to end her life. The note goes on to say that she cannot go on, that she's sorry for being a burden. I radio back to the police station and update them on the situation. I'm then forced to return to the living room and tell this woman's husband that he had failed to notice that he had been sleeping on her note overnight. That was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. We found her eventually, though it took another 8 hours or so to pin her down. We pinged her mobile phone to a nearby cell tower, but that just gave us a general locality. I tried to press the husband for information on where she may have gone, but he said that she didn't have any friends or family in the area. Later on, the husband telephones the police station and explains that they spent a weekend in a nearby seaside town shortly after they got married. I called the hotel they stayed in on that occasion, but they'd had no one by that name. I went down in person and showed them the picture. The lady at the desk told me that a guest answering that description had just left for a walk on the pier. When I went out to the pier in question, there she was. She actually seemed quite calm. There was nothing overly dramatic about her appearance or demeanor. She actually had the cheek to tell me that I looked awful, to which I explained jokingly that was partially her fault. I asked her to give life a chance for a few more days, that her husband loved her and that she wasn't a burden. She agreed and we brought her home. A couple of days later, she came to the station with a box of chocolates and a thank you card. One of those generic kinds that in no way revealed just what she was thanking me for. It was deeply surreal to receive a card like that for preventing the ending of someone's life. The family sends a similar card every year around the anniversary of the events. A stark reminder of just how effective good police work can be.